That's correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All right.
Plan to put that there just in case. We are making, curiously making requests, but we don't have anything.
We don't have anything right in hand.
Yes, and I'll remind the committee Monday and in the day is your last day for bill requests.
Monday's the last day, so get them in.
I heard Friday, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry?
I heard Friday. Has that been changed? Or was
it's Monday at 5 o'clock.
Monday at 5 o'clock, the 29th of January, 2007. I will note that we will have our first public hearings, 72-hour hearings, on bills on Monday. We have a number of them up. And then we'll do another information meeting. And then I think we're done with general information meetings on Tuesday. Paul.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We wanted to just spend a little bit of time with you before we get into the actual bills, kind of talking about some of the analysis we do. And actually, you got into, those of you who were able to attend the morning meeting, got into some of this discussion this morning on the different types of revenue impact analysis. But what we've done is kind of laid out some methodology issues as we see them. Chris and I will kind of talk about the things we do in legislative revenue. And then I think it's important for you to realize that the relationship we have with the Office of Economic Analysis and state economist Dave Beck is here and Michael Kennedy. And they're the ones who prepare the current law revenue forecast. That, by the way, will be our next joint meeting with the Senate. Will be Thursday, March the 1st, and that's when the forecast will be released for the general fund revenue and for the economy. But, you know, there's a lot of I think, some misconceptions that float around, and we wanted to make sure you understood kind of where we get these numbers that we'll show you and be sharing with you throughout the session. So I was going to talk about a handout called Orientation Methodology Issues. And then Chris will follow up, and he's going to talk about our income tax calculator we use for all of our income tax analysis, and since something that was mentioned this morning in the discussion, our OTIM, Oregon Tax Incidence Model, and kind of what we use for that, and I'll tell you the real story about California and kind of what happened in our relationship with California. actually, they helped us a great deal, but they're not doing it.
I have some concern
now.
There.
Well, we try to minimize our discussions in California. the most prominent statement you'll see from us is the revenue impact statement, and that's in statute that we're required to analyze each bill. Of course, I get the huge stack of them. Most of them are going to be no revenue impacts, and most of those you look at in other committees. But just a brief mention of the criteria we use for flagging them. And many times we'll flag bills, not so much because we think it's going to have a big revenue impact, but we think it may raise revenue issues. And we'll err on the side of, we don't want to miss something that does. But we will tend to include some things that may not in the end. The kind of criteria we use are things that affect state and local, and we do look for local government, cities and counties and so forth, and school districts that affect general revenue. And general is kind of can be a subjective term. For example, we don't usually look at fee proposals in the governor's budget. So that's not something that we will flag. If it is a general fee, like a document recording fee, and for example, we have a bill, we had a bill that helped fund county assessors a few years ago. We have a proposal for affordable housing that will expand that document filing fee. But that's a general revenue issue. And those are the kind of things we flag as having a revenue impact and having revenue implications. The other thing, of course, we do is, while it's not a revenue issue from the standpoint of the overall system, it is in terms of the individual school districts, is the formula issues. And that's why we've taken on that role of looking at proposed changes in the formula, the things that Steve talked with you about that will impact individual districts. So we'll flag all of those, and Steve will write a revenue impact on them. We tend to look at changes in the collection mechanism and just something that potentially has revenue implications, whether timing or actual amounts of revenue. We will tend to flag those, and you've got three of those on Monday that are from the property tax collectors that propose changes in the timing and method. Probably very minimal revenue impact, but nonetheless we'll include those and issue a revenue impact statement with them. Final thing I wanted to mention is that we are not staffed to do the extensive bill assessment that the fiscal office is. They have three full-time people who do fiscal impact statements. We do our revenue impact statements. We kind of divvy them up. Whoever draws the shortest straw gets. No, we have we go by our areas, and so I assign in each of our areas. They will cover all of the fees, all of the interest earnings kinds of changes that can have other fund impacts. So they'll usually pick up a number of things that we don't. And that's kind of, so we work in conjunction with them in that process. But we're really more of a policy-driven in terms of revenue policy and assessing these general revenue changes, whereas they're more comprehensive. Of course, you also see those fiscal impact statements are a part of our process as well. So you get any bills that you see in here, we'll have to work with fiscal on a fiscal statement. So those are just kind of some upfront things about the revenue impact statements. And let me tell you about what goes into those numbers, and that's under the revenue impact estimates. You heard the discussion today between static estimates and dynamic estimates. And I'll tell you kind of the interpretation we have of those terms. Static estimates we typically will use initially for most all small changes. One thing to keep in mind, when you see a revenue impact estimate, that will be from current law. So it will be including sunset extensions. So, for example, you've got a big, one of our biggest credits is sunsetting 1108, the pollution control credit. Well, that's current law, that there is no credit out there beyond 1108. And so if that is extended for one reason or another, that would be a revenue impact, because that would be a change from current law. In these static estimates, typically, we would assume no behavioral response. So that means that we'll take the forecast that the current law forecast as a given and say that this revenue impact or this revenue change does not change behavior in a material way. And that's what a static revenue impact estimate means. So usually most property tax measures, for example, small property tax change one way or another, we assume is a static analysis. Sometimes we do that because we genuinely think it's small enough, it's probably not going to affect things. The other time, a lot of times we'll also assume that just because we don't feel like we have strong enough information or knowledge at a detailed enough level to know how it may affect individual decisions. You may have noticed this morning that Senator Deckert was talking about the SIP, Strategic Investment Program. Many of you remember when that came in 1993, was proposed by Governor Roberts and adopted at the county level by Washington County and Hillsborough. And, there's been debate, would Intel have located their major fab facilities in Hillsborough if it would not been for that SIP, which capped property taxes $100 million. On something like that, that's such an individual decision, we don't feel qualified, we don't think anybody is, to go in and say, okay, Intel's going to do it because of that particular policy. So we will typically assume for those individual company decisions that are very specific, we will assume static analysis. So what that means is we can't come in and say this company would have come here if the exemption would not have come, the exemption would not have been in place. And so that's kind of an area sometimes there gets to be some confusion. And from our standpoint, a static estimate is kind of a fallback. We can look at that base and we can see what it is, and we can explain to you where our answer came from. We can't really say with any authority whether that influenced that individual decision. Now, unlike most other states, we do have dynamic estimates, and we have the capacity of what's state-of-the-art dynamic. They're not technically dynamic, but they're dynamic estimates in the sense that we have a model of the state economy, our OTIM model, and that allows us to look at the changes in the economy from a change in a major tax. So we're one of the few states that still does this. A number of states have gotten involved in it on a periodic basis. Massachusetts was one of the first. And, you know, I think one of the reasons states got involved was because people wanted particular answers to questions. And I think Phil Romero made some allusion to that today in his testimony. And I think that's been the case. There's been some who have argued a certain way, and then they want these models to show a certain answer. We've been very fortunate, I think, in Oregon, in the creation of OTEM back in 1999. I think it was a diverse group that wanted to see that type of analysis. There wasn't any set answer. We weren't told to come up with particular answers, and somebody would be disappointed if we came up with something different. And we established an oversight committee that included a couple of our revenue committee members at the time during the interim, and constructed this model with the assistance of California Department of Finance and Oregon State University. And so we think it's an objective analysis, a way to look at how the economy might respond. We're not going to say an individual company is going to make a decision differently, but if we look at the aggregates, if we look at labor markets, if we look at the total capital investment in the economy, we know that there are theoretical relationships, and we can build those into our model. And that's what we try to do. What the model does, it doesn't go through some of the analysis that Richard Sims suggested today on the demand side. Our model is a long-term model. It looks at only those supply-side relationships. So it looks at our attractiveness as a state for the factors of production, labor and capital. And we do think that our tax system and our expenditures over time do have some impact on that and do have the impact on our competitiveness relative to other states in the long run. And that's what our model tries to lay out. So you'll see some analysis from that model. I think if you have some major proposals, like a major income tax change, kinds of things we've used it for in the past, capital gains proposals we've used it. We've used it for the single sales proposal that was approved moving to a sales factor for multi-state corporate income. We've used it for, of course, sales tax proposals, you know, major tax reform proposals. We've used it. So we think it gives you some information that's useful, not something that's precise and you can bet on the job numbers or something, but it is something that I think gives you a sense of a direction of things, and it ties things together in a consistent way, so it allows you to help think through what the implications may be of a major tax change. So that's Chris is going to talk a little bit more about how that works and kind of get into a little bit of that discussion, and anybody who's masochistic enough to really want to go through the details, we'd be happy to do that.
Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, single sales forecasting. This morning, Dr. Sims says if we're within 34%, we've got to be, you know, rocket science. With regard to the single sales and other kinds of forecasts that are made by the Revenue Office, how close have we been? And I recognize that what are we, 60-some-odd percent out of whack this year in relationship to the historic calculations. So how close is the Legislative Revenue Office in actually coming up with those numbers? And do you retroactively go back and say, okay, this was our forecast. We could have done a little bit better job here and better job there inside of the 65% that the forecast itself was out?
Vice Chair Butler, we do some of that. The tax expenditure report gives us some kind of a truing up, because Department of Revenue is responsible for preparing that report, and so what they start off with, it was our impact estimate when the law came into being for the bill that was passed, and then they'll look back on the returns and say, here's what actually came in. So, you know, I think the short answer is, and we could look and give you more detailed answer, but the short answer is some of them we're pretty close on, and there's some of them we've been way off. And the one that comes to mind, and it, sometimes it's just how something ends up being implemented. What I'm thinking is the capital gains deferral that was approved back in 1995. What it did was allowed deferral of capital gains on investments in Oregon. And I think that had a price tag of maybe as much as $50 million for a biennium. And then that bill also required Department of Revenue to go back and study who used this. Well, the bill ended up being very complicated, and so by the time it became law, it didn't have the kind of impact we thought it would. And what the Department of Revenue found, after 2 years, there were 7 taxpayers, mostly farmers, who had used it. And the impact was, you know, less than $50,000.
Farmers will try most anything, Mr. Chair.
They were the only ones that saw merit in it. And everyone else shied away from it. We understood afterwards from the complexity of it implementing it. So there are certainly times when we'll miss it by a lot. Now, on the sales factor, you know, we have anticipated a revenue loss from that. We did score it and with our dynamic model. One thing I will say, too, about our OTM dynamic analysis, it is for a 5-year time horizon. And we assume it takes 5 years to work through the system. So, you know, Richard Sims was saying, or Phil Romero was saying, well, you know, it can be 20%. We're saying that's after 5 years. So it usually doesn't have much effect on your balancing of the current budget, whether it's a tax increase or a tax decrease, in terms of its secondary effects. Now, it may out there in the longer run, and that's something that we think, you know, you should be able to talk about and think about. The other thing that I was going to say about the sales factor, you know, we did anticipate a revenue loss from that, but the problem we've had on the corporate income tax, as I said before, is that corporate profits as a percent of national income are the highest they've been in 50 years. And we don't think that's because of the single sales factor, because that's happening worldwide. So obviously some other things often swamp that. It's hard to pull those other pieces out to look at our analysis compared to what, you know, kind of the assumption for the underlying economy was. The other thing I'll say on the dynamic estimates, the one area where most states do use dynamic analysis is on cigarette taxes, tobacco taxes. That's because they've been studied. One of the areas, most richest areas for data, is cigarettes. You know, we've got smoking data, we've got price data, we've got tax data for all the states, and it's very accessible. And I think Mazin was talking about that in your orientation, that we do have very detailed data, and we spend a lot of time because we know that the response to those excise taxes has increased as those taxes have gone up, and that prices are much different than they were 20 years ago. Yeah. You know, the whole master settlement was, in effect, a national excise tax on cigarettes. That's how it affected prices. It was just passed on. So that whole market has really changed. And, of course, when you get House Bill 2201, which should be coming here fairly soon, we'll talk about that in detail because we think that's a real important thing for revenue analysis is how we get to those numbers, because that will determine whether those funds are available to fund what you're hoping to fund. I'll just close and turn to Chris for a minute on the relationship between Legislative Revenue Office and Office of Economic Analysis. And, of course, I'm getting to the point. I've got my 8th anniversary at LRO is February 1st, and I was state economist for 9.5 years. So I'm going to feel there's going to be some when I exceed my state economist time. I don't know what the ground will shake or what, but so I've got the view of both offices, and I think we have done, and I'll be a bit of an advocate because I think we have set up the responsibilities in a very workable way that most states have not done. We rely on Office of Economic Analysis exclusively to provide you with current law forecasts. A lot of states have 2 forecasts. They'd have their equivalent of their Legislative Revenue Office do a separate forecast. You know, the governor's budget would come out with his forecast, and then you'd have a legislative revenue or legislative forecast. The decision made when Office of Economic Analysis was created in 1980, and Rich Munn was head of Legislative Revenue Office at that time, was that that's not an efficient way to run things. It causes confusion. There's no reason to duplicate that process. We have one in which one group, us, LRO, in the case of the forecast, acts as an advisor to review, but ultimate responsibility lies with DAS and Office of Economic Analysis. Whereas on the revenue impact statements, a lot of states have their Department of Revenue do it. And or some executive branch agency will come to you, here's the revenue impact. Our system has been that's our responsibility, and the agencies such as Department of Revenue work very closely with us, but they know that that's our responsibility to come up with those ultimate numbers and make those decisions. So I think that's been a system that's worked pretty well in minimizing confusion and also giving you, I think, some pretty objective information. The final thing I'll say is that when you're done here on June 29th,
or before.
So, as the Constitution says, as soon as practicable after sine die, the state economist will prepare a close of session estimate. What he'll do is he'll take his May 15 or his latest forecast, which hopefully will be May 15, and change it for all the revenue impacts that we've had, sum those up that affect the general fund, plus look at fiscal impacts, because it could be things like criminal fines and assessments and things that affect the general fund. Sum those up, add them, or graph them on top of that May 15 forecast, and that's your kicker base, your close of session estimate. So that's how those two are combined.
Thank you. And the states that deal with two sets of numbers either get two different numbers, which are confusing, or somebody looks at somebody else's paper if you end up with the same number.
I'm an accountant. I'm used to using two sets of books.
One presents. Representative Byrne.
Thank you. I just want to follow up a couple questions on that dynamic forecasting. I'm very interested in that. I think with some, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but with a couple of exceptions, these big things that we've modeled, whether it's, and I'm talking about major tax reform, whether it's income tax changes or sales tax or capital gains, we've modeled them, and because there's been lots of bills that have done that, but we haven't really implemented any of those as policy. Those bills haven't passed. And I guess my question is, how is it tested in the real world? And specifically, can input from other states, similar tax reform, be modeled in the Oregon model, or is it too Oregon-centric, when those states are actually implementing, so we can do a little before and after?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly right, Representative Broom, that there has been a lot of tax reform proposals and not a lot of not a lot of actual legislation. The way the model is built is we try to look at individual markets where the major components of the state economy, like the labor market. So we look at empirically how does the labor force respond to a change in the income tax rate, for example. And so we have estimates from across the country that allow us to try to do that. Where we also have estimates, for example, on how do changes in capital gains, for example, how does that affect the in-migration into the state of high-income individuals. Again, we have general estimates based on empirical evidence of that migration pattern. In Oregon, we've done some look at that specifically. So I guess, in short, we use as much data as we have, as we can find. In a model as detailed as our OTIM model, there are some relationships in there where the parameters, you know, the coefficients showing the relationship between two things, we think the sign is right, whether it's negative or positive. But in terms of the magnitudes, with Oregon-specific data, you know, we don't know that well. And for sales tax, for example, we know what that's done in other states, but in Oregon, it's been in a unique situation. We have a system that's been in place for a long time. We know, we border a state with the exact opposite kind of imbalance system. So there's some unique factors, and I wouldn't purport to suggest these are going to give you real precise estimates of how the economy would respond to big changes like that. But I think it would give you a magnitude or ballpark kinds of numbers.
But just to narrow it down just a little, if I may, Mr. Chair, it's never really been tested. I mean, once again, we wish we could test in Oregon sometime, but we don't get the opportunity. It really doesn't allow itself to be tested, say, Texas implements I don't know what their tax rates are, but let's say they implement or they double their income tax. Can we test that or not, basically?
Big changes like that, I would say no.
Okay.
I just don't think they happen often enough. Smaller changes like back to the cigarette tax, yes.
Yeah, okay.
We have a lot of analysis of that, and so we have a pretty good feel. But even that's a changing relationship, and we're changing kind of our estimates of elasticity. We've increased them as we kind of move up that price scale. So now we think it's more responsive than we did 15 years ago.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Paul, of the... the states that have the dual forecasting, how I'm just curious, how many of those states are close now to having this, I mean, coming out with the same numbers? And then if you do have a discrepancy that's huge, how did they determine, or which one supersedes the other?
Representative Olson, you know, my, and I haven't done a real detailed look at this, but just my observation, there tends to be a timing difference that creates changes. You know, and you just think of our own system. Let's say that you leadership told us to come up with an independent revenue forecast. Well, when would we do that? We'd probably do it in May, and the governor's would have been done in December, so you would have a natural change in the environment over that time period. That's one of the things that is common in these. But as far as kind of the decision-making, the ultimate decision-making in every state for the budget is the legislature's. So most of those budgets are going to be, if there's two forecasts, the budgets, legislatively approved budget, is going to be based on the legislative forecast. So that's typically the way it works. And I know that's in California, for example, is the legislative analyst's office who's responsible for the forecast that's used for the legislatively approved budget. And the governor has his own forecast that he bases his recommendations on, but it's the LAO budget forecast that drives the legislative budget.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I'm going to talk in a little more detail about two of the key tools that we use in the office. The personal income tax calculator, which is a key tool for understanding changes in the personal income tax. And then I'm going to add a couple of things to what Paula said about the OTIM model. The income tax calculator is a micro-simulation model based on 2004 income tax returns provided by the Department of Revenue. It's a sample of returns that's a stratified sample by income category, and it's about a 15% sample in total for the 2004 returns, and that was the most recent year for which we had complete data. And it is oversampled at the high end and the low end. And those 24 income groups, the sample is stratified by those. And it's also broken out by single and joint filers. And these are not strictly the single and joint. Those are the folks who pay the single rate. So those are single and separate filers. And the joint filers included in there are the head of household filers. And so what we have for the starting point is 2004 returns in this sample. And we receive a filer forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis of the joint filers and single filers throughout from 2005 through 2013. So we have that period going forward. So that allows us to incorporate the growth in the number of filers over time and then recalculate the tax for any given year between 2004 and 2013. And the calculations in there include all current Oregon and federal tax law. So all known changes that exist between now and 2013 are incorporated into the relevant tax years. And so that provides us kind of the baseline. And how we come up with a revenue impact is if we run it without any changes in current law, then we essentially simulate the current law forecast from the state economist, and then we would code in the policy change, whether it be a rate cut or a change in the personal exemption credit or whatever it is, change in the capital gains rate, and then run the simulation with that, with the code reflecting that new policy, and then compare the results. And that is the revenue impact, and that is on a liability basis. So for tax year 2007 or tax year 2008, we would have that change. And so that's kind of the starting point. And then we would map that to collections and how that money would come in across the fiscal years, which is the bottom line for the numbers that you're interested in, how it would affect the revenue stream in the biennium.
I have two questions. Anybody else? The first one is, how's the sample chosen? Is it a random sample within the stratifications, or is it done in some other way?
Mr. Chair, it's a random sample within the stratifications.
Great.
And it's the oversampling at the high end and the low end are an attempt to account for the variability at those ends.
Sure.
In the income components. And it actually presents a quite intricate multivariate statistical challenge for getting a rich enough sample to incorporate all of the nuances of every income component, every credit, and every deduction.
Lots of fun for the social scientist.
Yes.
Yes, perfect. Does the state economist use the same model for calculating expected income taxes in the projections that he gives us?
Mr. Chair, no, they use something different. They have their own model.
Okay.
And they're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Okay. Right.
But we do true them up, if you will. So we have their forecast, and so that'll be the starting point. And then when I run the model and essentially come up with a current law forecast based on this, the 2004 basis, they are different, and they are trued up through making the liabilities line up so that our tax calculator does line up with the current law, the official current law forecast.
So as not to confuse the legislature. That's good. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, the 24 groups of income, is that based upon adjusted gross income or taxable income so that you can identify each of the elements that make up the income, each of the credits that are used in the income?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, it is based on gross income, total income. And it's done that way. That's kind of the starting point. That's the tax base, if you will. And then from within that, in each of these groups, the sample is large enough so that each return that is in the sample represents a certain number of returns in the population. And the 24 income groups allows us to get at the many differences that low income versus high income filers that are in the $10,000 to $15,000 income range tend to have certain characteristics, and those characteristics are very different from the tax filers in the income $140,000 to $150,000.
And just a clarification, if I may, please, Chris. We talk about it's based upon gross income. Are you still talking about adjusted AGI?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, I'm sorry. It's the total income. It's before the adjustments.
Okay, so it's really gross income before any adjustments to the AGI.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right.
That's correct.
And just to translate, what I think that means is that you have a complete picture of the income within your random sample and how that income is adjusted in various categories to get to the tax that's actually paid.
And the credits that are applied to it eventually.
Yes, that's correct. And within for this sample, there are stripped of identifiers. I mean, the confidentiality restrictions are very tight, and the Department of Revenue is very careful about that information. So it's stripped of all identifiers, and there is some a blurring of some data in certain cases so as to not to reveal specifics.
In the case of very unusual tax returns.
Yes.
You'd have to do that in order not to identify the taxpayer.
And in some cases, the department will go through it, and if there is a very strong outlier, then that return most likely would not be included if there's something very unusual about it. And part of the reason behind that is confidentiality, but as well as the purpose of the tool is it represents, this is kind of the base distribution and how it would grow forward. If there's something very unusual in a given year, we wouldn't want to assume that occurs every year, especially if we only think it occurs every 10 years or if there was something highly unusual about it.
So it is a random sample with with exceptions.
Yes.
Okay.
There is some at the end there, largely driven by confidentiality, as well as the purpose of the sample.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one further follow-up, Chris. You have to make calculations on a lot of different kinds of returns. We're talking about corporate returns. We're talking about individual income tax returns. We're talking about death tax returns as well. So is it 24 samples in each of those areas? Or tell me where the samples, numbers of samples on the various kinds of returns.
Vice Chair Butler, this is just personal income tax returns. Okay. They're the Form 44, again, the 1040 for the federal level. It is not the corporate returns, and it is not the estate returns.
Because, Mr. Chair, the question I was looking for was how you get the same base data for calculation projection purposes when there's a proposed change in death taxation or corporate taxation, those kinds of things, or fiduciary for that matter.
One of the things we know about dealing with numbers is that the smaller the set of numbers is and the more randomly it's distributed, the less likely you are to be able to make predictive statements about it. And that's true of any kind of numbers.
Right.
So you can do it with the income tax because there's a lot of returns. It's much more difficult to do it in the case of other kinds of tax returns where there are many fewer returns and they tend to be more scattered. After all, you're only going to file one inheritance tax return. One will be filed on your behalf, whereas you file many, many income tax returns.
We hope.
Yeah.
Many happy returns, Mr. Chair.
Other questions on this issue? Go ahead.
Okay, moving on to OTIM, just to add to some of what you heard this morning as well as what Paul touched on just a few moments ago. It was directed by the 1999 legislature and primarily developed in a kind of joint venture between LRO, Washington State University, and Oregon State. And it was largely or partially based on California's dynamic revenue analysis model. Without going into a lot of the detail about it, because that can be painful, I guess, for listeners, not necessarily. I'd be happy to do it.
We hope you find it fascinating.
The agents or the actors or the players in the model are firms, households, government, and the rest of the world, kind of everything outside of Oregon. And the model is broken down into these players. And the key thing about the dynamic aspect of it is the relationship between these different agents, if you will. And their interrelations. Firms and households, for example, households supply labor and capital to firms, and firms supply households with goods and services. So you have that kind of circular relationship. Firms also supply goods and services to each other, so-called intermediate goods that are part of their production process. The interaction with the government is largely through taxes and paying for the infrastructure of the state. And then the rest of the world is kind of the export or trade sector in Oregon with everybody else. And there isn't a way to look at Oregon and trade with California or Washington per se. It's just everybody outside of Oregon. And a lot of these assumptions are for simplification purposes to make the model actually usable and it doesn't get bogged down in too much detail. And then within these actors, OTIM is a computable general equilibrium model, CG model, and it, as Paul was saying, it assumes that the current economy is in equilibrium, which isn't actually true because things are changing all the time, which presents a number of challenges, especially going back and seeing how close we were in certain estimates because everything changes. But it does show, so we have that equilibrium. And then we apply essentially a shock to the system, something that's big enough to stir the economy out of equilibrium, and then it settles back into equilibrium, and that gives us our 2 points in time to compare so that we can sense the general magnitude of the changes in the economic variables that provide the basis for the dynamic aspect. Just to try and provide a little more context to it, the number of sectors in the model, if you will, we have 29 industrial sectors. So you have agriculture and manufacturing and things of that nature, and those are broken down into some subsectors. Agriculture, there's a livestock as well as crop sector. Manufacturing has a couple of pieces. There are the two factors of production, the labor and the capital, which are really a foundation for the model. There are 8 households, and those are by income group, so we have a low income to high income, and each household represents all of the actual households that fit into that income category, so we can see how the tax incidence falls on the different income level families. And then there are 58 state and local government sectors, if you will, and 11 federal. And the reason for that disproportionate number is the purpose of the model is to study the impact of tax law changes. So there are a lot of attention was paid to building all of the state and local, in particular, tax sectors, income taxes, property taxes, even some of the more, the finer taxes. But it is a tool for big changes. It really does a good job at changes to the corporate tax, personal income taxes, property taxes. But if there's a change that is a very niche change, then this is, really isn't the right tool for it. Again, it has to be large enough, if you will, to throw the economy out of equilibrium and bring it back in. And again, as I was saying before, some of the key relationships in the model, Paul mentioned labor supply, that's a key one, and how the labor responds to various things like personal income taxes. So we have parameters in there that say we expect low-income families to respond to taxation in a certain way, and that varies across the income group of the household. And then one thing that's a little bit different for this CG model as compared to other states' models is that ours incorporates a tax burden distribution analysis, and that was by design, and it was kind of married into the process. Some states, Minnesota, for example, produces a very detailed tax incidence distribution, which is based on a micro simulation, kind of a static estimate, if you will. But the office merged these together when the model was developed, precisely to answer or provide some insight into how large tax changes would affect the different income families.
I could just add a couple of things, Mr. Chair, in closing it. Just follow up on Chris's last point there on the tax incidence. That is unique to our model, and I think it's part of the reason for... You know, I said that when we first were given the charge to do this, to develop this model, there wasn't a specific answer that people were looking for. And we had a lot of questions on this, kind of how do jobs affected by tax change, but also how is the distribution of the tax burden affected? And, of course, a lot of our proposals have been for consumption taxes, which have a lot different distributional effect than the income tax system we have now. So we think that's a unique component. Incidence is the final incidence of a tax. So it's how after-tax income is affected after wages and prices have changed. So, for example, when we have, and we always have to explain this, when we have a reduction in the income tax, what happens is gross wages go down. People think, well, how can that happen? Well, it's net income goes up, net wages go up, as there's a decrease in taxes and tax burden, people are willing to work more. So you get an increase in the supply of labor, which reduces wages. So we're able to track back through those kinds of secondary effects and track the ultimate burden of the tax, many consumption taxes back to consumers and to the households that pay those, and also the factor taxes, labor and capital. So I think it gives you a unique way to look at who's going to ultimately bear the tax burden. And if we do get to the point, particularly looking at some major tax changes, I think it's a good tool to help you in that process. The other thing I'd say, and last thing, is kind of relating back to this morning's discussion and some of the points that were raised by Richard Sims on the expenditure side. We do have an expenditure model. This model balances, meaning that if we cut taxes, then we've got to cut spending. We've got a balanced budget requirement, just like you operate under. But our expenditure block is not as well developed. We don't have the empirical evidence that, you know, links expenditures with economic growth in a shorter time horizon. We're looking at a 5-year time horizon. We think most expenditures, like the education expenditures, can be significant, but probably over a longer time horizon. Mm-hmm. And the only breakdown we have in our model is between education and non-education. So the education does show up in higher salaries and wages and so forth of teachers, but the the non-education is not very detailed. So if I were to say what would this model need to improve longer run, would be, you know, a flushing out of that expenditure block. And with the amount we've looked at it, we do have some parameters in there. There's not a lot of empirical evidence on it because I think of the time horizons involved. But that's something where I can see some improvement in the future at some point.
Questions? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could either of you tell me why... why the model doesn't include land as a factor of production?
The land is included as a residual factor of production. It's not something that varies in the model. So it's not something that's responsive.
Yeah. Okay.
So we've toyed a little bit. In fact, we had Dave Holland do some work a couple of years after the model was built, looking at the property tax. And you may see some bills that try to distinguish between the property tax on land and the property tax on improvements. So we've looked at that and tried to make that distinction within the model.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have generally seen OTIM on projections when we're contemplating making big changes to the tax system and it's predicting what the effect would be if we do something. Is there some mechanism, too, to look back at things that did change and then try to look at what was predicted and see if it turned out the way we thought it would, to just sort of check this model and see how accurate it is?
Representative, I think, as Paul was saying before, we've done a little bit of that, but because everything is changing, it's hard to really go back and reset everything that goes into... Whenever an estimate is made, we kind of have assumptions about how we expect the economy to unfold over the next few years. And then we model that simulation and we say how they'll change. To go back and actually see how correct we were is a formidable task, because everything, all of the assumptions that were made, explicit and implicit, changed over that time period and may have had an impact on that policy as well.
So we see our results really as, you know, it's not a forecasting model. So we're not forecasting what's going to happen. We're forecasting how we may deviate from what the baseline forecast is. So, you know, we could do that partially. We would, if we pulled out the forecast difference, for example. And the trick would be trying to pull out how much of that difference was due to, you know, the model predicting the change that from the tax change, and how much it was due to, you know, the misassumption about the national economy and state economy. We could try to look into that and see if we could parse that out and maybe give you an idea.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, yeah, and just a comment. It just seems like it would be interesting to pick out a couple of maybe dramatic examples of where we made big changes. And I know, mm-hmm. obviously, you can't control everything else that changed in the meantime, but just try to look at, you know, whether the projection was in the ballpark or, you know, because otherwise it seems like we have this great model, but we're really not fine-tuning it to see, are there assumptions built into it that might need to be adjusted a little bit? I mean, really, it's mainly designed to help us when we're trying to make these choices know what the implications are. So,
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How big does a change need to be for OTIM to be relevant and a useful tool, or proposed change, I should say?
You know, Representative Reed, we had that discussion when we first developed OTIM, and we had a policy advisory committee, and Representative Witt was chair of that committee, as I recall. And
the other Representative Witt.
The other Representative Witt, the conclusion we had, the recommendation at the time, I think was over $10 million in impacts. But the kind of the way that the recommendation was either $10 million or, you know, agreement on the part of the chair and vice chairs that this was appropriate. Because we think there's some times when it might not be appropriate even with a $10 million, and maybe with a smaller, it may be something the model can give us some idea. So I don't think that's a hard and fast rule. What we can do, and what we'll try to do when we discuss analysis with you, is recommend whether we think it's meaningful or not.
I see.
And you know, if we don't, we'll tell you. If we think it's not something that the model we think would be capable of helping you with.
Thanks.
Thank you. I guess we're ready to move on.
Mm-hmm. So, turn it over to Day and Michael. As I said, they will be back with you on March 1st with the March revenue forecast.
Well, and some of us had the privilege of seeing them talk in the Ways and Means Committee as well, and it'll be interesting to see. There they talk more about the actual results, and here we're interested in how they get there.
Chair Barnhart and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Beck, the acting state economist of the Office of Economic Analysis. And here with me is Michael Kennedy, our senior economist with the same office. We appreciate the opportunity to present to you the overview of our economic and revenue forecast process, the methodology, and the practice we do. I included a couple of slides to give you a little bit about the history of OEA, which Paul mentioned moments ago, and what other functions we do in our office. And the second slide, obviously, our forecast process is advised by three distinct committees. Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, DAS Advisory Committee, and Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors. By the way, the last one, Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors, was formed in 2003, after we had a fiscal crisis in 2001-03 session. And we also implemented so-called OILI, one of the leading economic indicators to see how the economy is going, where is it is going, what's going to happen down the road. So we learn things from crisis, and we're no exception. The next slide shows how we actually implement economic and revenue forecast process. The first step is to receive national forecast from our national forecast provider, Global Insight. We review their forecast with Governor's Council of Economic Advisors in pre-meeting, and we discuss the forecast and the assumptions behind the forecast. With the recommendations from the council, our office starts on working on economic model. So we put together a preliminary forecast, which will be reviewed by two committees, Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and DAS Advisory Committee. By the way, when Paul left to LLO, he left a good system behind. So we're making improvements over the good system he left with us. With the recommendations from DAS Advisory Committee and the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, we put out our final economic forecast, and the numbers there will be used for personal income tax models and corporate income tax models. When we put together preliminary revenue estimates, the numbers are reviewed by Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors, and we incorporate legislative policy changes and non-income tax revenue forecast to put out our final revenue forecast. In our economic model first, and Michael will talk about the revenue forecast models, we focus on income, employment, prices, housing sector, and population. And almost all of them will be used for revenue forecast purpose, and in personal income Look at all the components there, and wages and salaries is the biggest component, consisting of 55% of total personal income. This number has varied over time, and when we had a natural resources focus, we had about 60% of total income was wages and salaries. At this point, it's 55%. If we include other labor income, which is employers' insurance contribution and pension contribution, it's about 68-69% of total personal income. In employment sectors, we split the entire sector into two, private and public. And in private sector, of course, we have broken down into many different industries. And we pay close attention to construction, particularly these days, and manufacturing and non-manufacturing. Non-manufacturing would include trade sectors like retail and wholesale, and also service sectors. In terms of prices, we forecast PDX, Portland, Salem Metro Area Consumer Price Index, and also Oregon House Price Index. And we forecast housing starts in Oregon, and also with the help of our demographer, we put out a population forecast too. What are the drivers for income and employment in Oregon? Of course, we sift through a ton of information about national and international economy. And our economy is exposed to both national and international economic conditions. In the equations in income sectors, the major drivers, of course, are national income trend and forecast. But of course, wages and salaries in Oregon will be a function of Oregon's employment. Now, population is a big driver for all other components of personal income. Now, in employment equations, of course, the drivers are national trend and forecast. And we also consider the impacts coming from Oregon's income and population to service sector and trade sectors. All in all, it's over 60 equations and identities all simultaneously determined. These equations are updated on an annual basis. But we had an implementation of new industry coding system starting in 2001. So we have consistent data on employment and personal income based on NAICS only from 2001. And some of the data that we have for prior to 2001 is a careful reconstruction of history. Some of the challenges we have is a lack of data over a long period of time. Before 2001, we had data starting from 1973. At this point, some of data start from 1990, and some data start from 2001 on a consistent basis. How do we put out our final numbers in economic side? In the short term, we use a lot of add factors. That means we use our forecast adjustment. For out years, we depend on model predictions. Now, how long is a short term? We're looking at about a couple of years. So when we use add factors to adjust numbers coming from model prediction, we look at some of the sectors bucking the national trend, and we rely on advice from our advisory committees. And by the way, these committees are advisory committees, not policy committees. They are not setting policies. In the end, we own the numbers. We will be held responsible for our numbers. Now, about relying on model prediction for out years, of course, national and Oregon trends are important, and consistency of our forecast is checked against some key ratios. And by the way, in doing so, we're assuming that the Global Insight forecast is largely correct. About forecast performance, if we look at personal income growth, in May 2005, we put out this forecast, the very first line. 2005, we forecasted 6.3%, 2006, 6.2%. In December 2006, of course, 2004 changed, and the history keeps changing. The Bureau of Economic Analysis has a reputation for going back and revise personal income with much variance, and so it's really hard to keep up with them. But if you look at our forecast we put out in May 2005 is relatively close to the current forecast. We saw a slowdown coming. If you look at employment growth in 2006, when we put out our forecast in May 2005, we saw we forecasted 1.5% growth in 2006. Now, at this point, with almost all the data in, preliminary estimate is 3.2% growth for 2006. What's the difference? The big difference was the very first quarter of 2006. 2006, the economy was still strong, created a ton of jobs in our Oregon. And what happened was, since then, our employment growth is averaging just a little over 1%, which is very much consistent with our view. So if there was anything, then we were ahead of the curve instead of behind the curve. We looked at a substantial slowdown in the economy in the second half of 2006. We saw that, and we saw also a slowdown continuing in 2007. Now, in that sense, with an exception of a strong growth in the second half of 2005 and very early part of 2006, we believe that the forecast we had in May 2005 is roughly consistent with what we are witnessing these days. Now, I briefly mentioned that after 2001-03 crisis, we've implemented a couple of changes. On the revenue forecast side, we instituted Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors. On the economic side, we implemented Oregon Index of Leading Economic Indicators. And it gives us a guidance on our outlook on the economy down the road, about 6 to 9 months ahead. And it's been a good indicator for us. And Michael Kennedy, our senior economist, will talk a little more about that and with the rest of revenue forecast methodology.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. I think it's important to take a few minutes to look at this leading index. Because of the general nature of forecasting, one of our hardest obstacles in forecasting, obviously, is forecasting major changes in the economy, and in particular, downturns. And leading indexes are designed to sort of try to give you a lead on a recession, seeing one coming rather than finding out you're already in one 2 quarters after it started. So that's the point. And how are they constructed? As you can see here, there's a list of the indicators that go into the index. And it's basically half and half, 5 national indicators and 5 Oregon-based indicators. And as you can see by their nature, they vary, because the whole point is that no recession is identical to any other recession. There's a lot of different factors, a lot of different types of recessions. So no one indicator is going to give you a lead on every recession. They vary in nature. So you use a broad array of indicators. A few of them, you hope, will give you a lead on any given type of recession. So that's their nature. There's a lot of art to these. There's not a direct one-to-one relationship between the value of this index and, say, employment growth. But you hope that there's enough of a correlation there that you get a better lead on a recession than you otherwise would have. So moving on, this, got my handy-dandy. Oh, that's a little too far away. Well, I'll just use this guy right here. This is the graph of the Oregon Index of Leading Indicators. The dark line is the actual 6-month change in the index. The index is just an equal-weighted composite of all 10 of those indicators. So this is the average of what each indicator is doing or saying. And so the dark line is the 6-month change in the index, and the light line is the 6-month change coincident in employment. And this is a fairly short time period. Obviously, if this index is sort of designed to give you a lead on a recession, we only have one recession in the timeline of these data. You'd like to have a longer period of time. However, the point of this particular index was to answer the question, could you have seen the last recession coming? And since the last recession was really an investment cycle recession that hit high tech in particular, we've got semiconductor book-to-bill ratio as one indicator that might give you a lead on that sector. It only goes back to 95, so that sort of limits the time we have of this. But going back and looking at the performance of the indicator, what we're looking for here is basically a signal. A signal being a significant decline in the index, coupled with more than half of the indicators basically being in decline. And so you have a signal, and then the question is, okay, of what value was that signal to you? So in the history of this index that we have here, we basically have 2 signals. We have one that peaked, or bottomed out, if you will, in early 1998, and then we have another signal here beginning in the latter half of 2000. And so let's look at the first signal. Well, at this time, employment slowed down. Employment growth had been really strong, and it slowed down. But no, we did not go into a recession. So this is what you would call a false signal, because it signaled a recession, but one didn't happen. Obviously, the second signal was followed about 10 months later by a decline in employment and ultimately the recession. So this is what you would call a positive signal. It said, hey, be on the lookout. A recession is possibly on the future, and one eventually happened. One of the things, one interesting thing is it wasn't until basically early 2002 that the estimates of employment for 2001 turned negative. So at the time that the recession was happening, the preliminary employment estimates were actually positive. So that's one of the things we grapple with are these, as Dave was mentioning, with these revisions to history as you're going along.
So the leading indicator actually was lagging.
Mr. Chair, the leading indicator went negative in about the middle of 2000. Employment turned negative in the second quarter of 2001. We did not know that employment in the second quarter of 2001 was negative until early 2002. It is the information on the economic conditions that was lagging the actual conditions. The index in this particular instance, and obviously it signals this recession because it was designed, it was a retrospective. Could we have seen this coming? You take all these things, you meld them together, and lo and behold, because of the things you picked, semiconductor book-to-bill, manufacturing indicators, things that were prevalent in this downturn, lo and behold, your index predates them. But we also have a number of other indicators that should signal other potential types of recessions. So the one other point I wanted to make.
Just to make sure I understand that point before we go on.
Sure.
I think what you said a minute ago is that the indicators were signaling down, but you didn't have the information for a while after that. Is that right, or did I misunderstand that?
Mr. Chair, maybe I need to clarify something. We did not have this index in place at that time, so there was no index for us to be looking at. What we're basically asking ourselves now is, suppose we had, and suppose we were sitting there and we were seeing this thing called negative, would we have bought into, you know, the imminent, you know, impending recession in a year?
And so
this wasn't in place.
The information was available close to the time when it indicated it would be going negative. You weren't looking at it because it wasn't part of an index that you were using at that time.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
We only actually pursued this line. The Conference Board has done the U.S. leading index for many, many years.
Yes.
We pursued this, which is an analogy to that, for Oregon, in the wake of the downturn and the question, couldn't you guys have seen this coming earlier? And then the whole note on the employment revisions is just that even in your real-time data can be masked, and you don't even know you're in recession and you're in one. So that was the other point. So what we want to ask here, obviously going forward, the question is, okay, when this thing gives you a signal, when it turns negative, are you going to be, you know, running around like a rooster with his head chopped off yelling recession? And really, it's a lot more complex than that. And I'll tell you why, because obviously in history here, let's suppose we were here, would we have been calling recession? And then again, here, would we have been calling recession? And these are important points to make, because in hindsight, yeah, of course, a recession occurred. But to be looking at it, in particular, given the fact that it's mildly negative right now, and there is some concern, is this boding recession or not? So I want to turn to sort of some recent analysis we've done, methodological improvements, which is to analyze the components underlying each signal and to say, okay, is there something you can garner there about the nature of the signal? So let's start, and there's 3 points I want to look at. Let's look at the underlying components for the signal when it was at its bottom point here. Same thing here. And then let's look at what the components are doing right now. So the next slide basically shows the contribution to the signal. So you have to start with, what was the signal? In January 1998, the leading index was down 16%, 6 months on an annualized basis. So that's a very strong negative signal. This is the contribution to that signal. So at this point, the dollar was doing almost all the work. The dollar was basically driving this index negative. And the reason for that was, at the time, it was the Asian financial crisis. The dollar was appreciating dramatically, and that would be expected to curb or dampen our exports. That would be one dampening factor on the economy. Now, if you looked at this and said, well, the dollar's doing all the work, there's that one dampening factor. But otherwise, our economy is going excellent. Employment growth is great. It's going great. You would probably discount this particular signal as an outlier and not be saying, factoring in, say, a recession scenario into your economic and revenue forecast outlook. Now let's fast forward to April 2001. Still at this point, no mention of recession even in our publications that I can find. So still, you know, the outlook was slowing but no recession. At this point, basically, almost all indicators are giving some kind of negative signal, in particular the semiconductor book-to-bill ratio. Investment spending, business investment spending, particularly on computers, was taking a nosedive, and that's what you're seeing there. So this is really, the signal is consistent with the nature of the recession we were seeing, but some other signals that aren't directly tied to manufacturing. Help wanted ads, unemployment claims, the dollar even was, you know, appreciating. So a lot of basically a diverse set of indicators signaling this. So you would buy a lot more into this, and then it looks more broad-based. And in fact, ultimately, the recession did come to take place.
Is that first one, is that a measure of inventory versus sales, in effect?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's the ratio of orders, bookings to bill.
Yes.
The measure of orders coming in to the billings, otherwise going out. So when those bookings slow relative to the orders going out, it's basically a precursor to a real slowing in the manufacturing.
Right. Things may be going just fine today, but I don't have orders for future production.
Exactly. Now, finally, moving on to November is the latest instance of this indicator, and the signal is negative 3.9. I would consider that a weak signal. It's not a signal of recession, but it's probably very consistent with what we're already projecting, which is a slowdown in employment growth, sort of a pause in the economy for a few quarters, and then a resumption of long-term growth. But and what's happening here is it's basically your culprits that we're seeing in the slowdown anyway. We're seeing a manufacturing slowdown nationwide. Employment's slowing, so unemployment claims are going to go up a bit. Help wanted ads are going to go down a bit. So it's really consistent with the economic scenario that would have been outlined in our previous forecast and that you will get in the next forecast on March 1st. So we consider this a valuable addition to our forecasting process, and obviously we'll devote considerable analytical time to it in the future. Moving on to the revenue forecast. I'll talk about general revenues or general fund revenues first and then move on to lottery at the end. But first, some guiding principles. As Paul's already mentioned, this is a current law forecast. And so that's all we can consider. You know, any impending bills, even if we suspected that they were almost probable to happen, we would not be able to factor those in. I'll give you one particular instance. House Bill 2152 passed, major tax package passed by the 03 legislature. Then you had the referendum out there, and the vote was going to come due. Well, it was almost like very likely that that was going to pass, you know, the reversion of those tax factors. Still, we could not, until the March forecast of 04 or whenever it was, factor that reversal into our forecast. So there's one instance. We strive as best we can for an unbiased, most likely forecast, sort of. So in the probabilistic sense, we try to hit the center. The absolute data point we give you, that revenue data point, we suspect is the most likely outcome, but a forecast is really a distribution around that likelihood. And so you can expect the actual outcome to be up or down relative to that. The likelihood of hitting it on the nose is actually nil. You want the likelihood of falling close to it to be high, and that's what we strive for. We continue, as we've mentioned here, to refine our models, to take into account new data sources, to employ the input from experts that we have out in the field and in our colleague offices, to refine our models and improve the accuracy of our forecast. And for every forecast, particularly since, you know, the downturn and those budget shortfalls, we provide that range, that idea of the range you can expect to fall within. What are the downside worst-case scenarios? What are the upside best-case scenarios? To give you an idea for your budgeting purposes. This table just shows the December forecast for current biennial general fund revenues. I just want for a reference point, sort of a background, the actual values currently at $12.7 billion projection. The distribution by source, most are aware now in Oregon, it's gotten a lot of fanfare about the highly concentrated nature of our general fund revenue stream in the income taxes, totaling over 93% of revenues related to this source. The next column actually shows the percent change from the prior biennium, which gives a good indication of why we're experiencing sort of the awash in revenue, you know, stories we're hearing now. 23% growth in personal income is actually the highest in the history of my data, or our data. That compares to, at least in the last quarter decade, about 12% biennial growth. So very phenomenal. Corporate income tax would actually be up 42% if not for the current kicker that is going out, about $137 million. So extraordinary growth. And then finally, sort of from this longer-term methodological standpoint, the contribution to the current error of the forecast. If we assume that December's right and we compare it to the close of session forecast, the December forecast is about almost $1.4 billion above that close of session forecast. If you look at that error, that current error, and you parse it out into the contribution, about 70% of the error is directly related to unanticipated personal income tax revenues. About 20% is related to corporate income tax, and it's interesting to compare. Okay, corporate income tax comprises 6%, but it's contributing 20% of the error. That really just speaks toward the incredible volatility of that tax source, that it carries more weight from sort of an error standpoint than it does even in its absolute sense. Inheritance taxes.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Michael, the one-time items, what do those include?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, primarily in this particular instance, there was a senior deferral transfer. They're all one-time legislative actions, primarily transfers that are taken from other funds. And in this case, they're very small. In the 0103 session, they amounted to almost $600 million.
Thank you.
Certainly. Right. So the point here just being when you look at, and these are fairly in line with long-term contributions. When you look over time at closed session forecast errors, this is about how it falls out. Personal income tax has the greatest impact because it's the largest one. Corporate has a greater impact than it should given its size because of its volatility. And so obviously then we focus a lot of our analytical efforts to trying to minimize errors in those two major components, personal and corporate income tax. With that, I'll basically characterize what we do. We use statistical modeling, econometric modeling for these major categories. The office itself is responsible for the personal income tax, corporate income tax, and cigarette and tobacco forecasts in-house, and utilizes econometric modeling to model those and forecast those revenues. Other agencies that may have more direct expertise for their collections, including Liquor Commission, Judicial, Consumer and Business Services, you see the numbers listed up here, they basically engage in their own statistical modeling and provide us with those revenues, basically employing their expertise in the area to better produce those forecasts. And then for minor or very static or stable revenue sources, we use simple trend analysis.
Sure. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, in statistical sampling, it's a plus or minus error factor. And this is kind of off the cuff, but what would happen if you were to say plus or minus 5%, and we were to take the 5% off the top and say, fine, we'll take that minus 5%, and I realize that from a prior graph that you hone in on those differences as you get along further. But if we were to take that 5% or 3% or whatever the variance is that you use in your statistical sampling, and say, fine, we'll put that into a reserve fund. Would that be how difficult would that be, and what would be the implications from an economical standpoint? Would it work? Could it work?
Pardon me, Chair, Vice Chair Butler. Pardon me, I'm struggling with a
pretty here. Bad, you know. I'm sorry, it wasn't such a good idea after all.
I will get at some point to looking at sort of the historical variance of close of session forecasts. And in fact, if you take that midpoint estimate that we produced May 15th and you look at that historical variance, that would be one of the ways in which you could go about saying exercising some, some security on your own part, some self-preservation, if you will, against, say, large budget shortfalls. It's certainly one way to go. It can be argued for.
Well, I'm just looking at it, Mr. Chair, that certainly that would be a judicious way, because if you say, well, this is going to be $10 billion in personal income tax plus or minus 5%, well, why don't we just go ahead and say, fine, minus 5%, let's put a reserve in for $500 million at that particular point, not spend it. And use it for the opening balance the next time. So I'm just wondering.
And I think in analyzing the value of that approach, we want to know what direction the error tends to run, and I suspect you're going to get into that in a bit. Go ahead.
I'm going to spend a little bit of time on personal income tax because it's the largest source. This is the system that we're modeling, the fact that economic conditions, both Oregon and nationwide, sort of dictate or determine the levels of income that will be made in taxable in Oregon, given a current law tax code that results in a tax liability. And then, of course, as we've heard described, there will be some pattern of collections related to that liability over time. So this is what we're trying to model overall. The personal income tax model at its basis is a tax liability model. It focuses on tax years and the amount of income and the amount of liability that is generated in that tax year, because that there's a direct relationship between the economic conditions at that time and the income that's earned. So we start there with tax years, and we base the model on tax return data for both income and tax liability from 1980 to, at this point, 2004. I just got preliminary statistics for 2005. So there again is that data lag issue. It can be a while before you know why in the world all these people were sending all this money.
Mr. Chair, I think I know why those people were sending that money, and it has to do with other factors, but we won't go there. Maybe because it's their tax bill.
Perhaps so.
We break gross income, and income actually shows up on the federal form. Remember, our Oregon form starts with AGI, but we get information on the types of income from the federal form. And we break that down into eight types that we think are distinctive and probably related to different types of economic activity. They are wage and salaries, interest, dividends, capital gains, retirement, proprietorships, or Schedule C, Schedule E, which is rents, royalties, and other pass-through types of income, and then other, which is quickly becoming a very infinitesimal part as the unknown part, the unmatchable part, goes away. So really there's seven major and just one residual. And for each type of income, we basically model that income on variables that seem to do a good job of predicting changes in that income. Now for wages, as we've already heard mentioned, our economic model already has in it personal income and divided into components, one of which is the wage and salary component of personal income. Now personal income is administered by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and their definition is identical to taxable wages and salaries in Oregon. But the two move so well together that just really basing our forecast of wage and salary income that will show up on tax returns on this variable personal income and wages is an incredibly tight fit. Other equations, one example, the capital gains income is based on the Wilshire 5000 market index, which we feel is a broad index that gets really at more of the broad base price appreciation in equities in the country. And then finally, given sort of gross income level and a projection of gross income, we then use the relationship between that income and liability, what we'll term the gross effective tax rate, to basically then determine liability projections going forward. This is a table. I actually just got these data a couple days ago. This is the preliminary 2005 values for the different segments of income. This is for full year resident filers only. And then the liability, the distribution here, very in line with wage and salaries in the personal income and nationally, they constitute about 65% of our taxable income in Oregon. The next largest group, and growing obviously with demographics, is retirement, currently about 11% of taxable income. That's pensions, IRAs, and taxable Social Security. Followed by that is capital gains, which has made a major resurgence. This level right here, 8.9%, that was roughly the level in 2000, and then we saw that retract considerably in 2001, 2002. It's made a major resurgence, and you can see this third column here is the percentage change from the prior year. Overall income grew 10.4%. That's relative to a long-term average of about 6%. So again, still giving insights into what's been going on here this biennium with large inflows of personal income taxes. But overall income grew considerably, and it was driven in primarily by a very large jump in capital gains. 03 capital gains were up 23%, 04 was 45%, and now we're looking at 53%. So an incredible run of 3 years of capital gains growth. Now this is biased upward a bit by a certain sale of Nike stock. There's roughly about $1 billion of income in there that we assume is one time. So it's upward biased. But even without that, you're looking at 39%. So an incredible run of capital gains income. We're not getting into the forecast here, but this is really the output and how the model operates at its basis. It's a modeling of those factors, liability and effective rate, and projecting that forward based upon the economic variables we have in our model.
It's interesting to note that the wage increase is exactly on for the 15-year period and the one-year period.
Yes, Mr. Chair, 05 from that standpoint really is sort of a characteristic year. It's sort of on that long-run trend line. It's not always the case. The year before was about 6.1%. Next year we're forecasting at about 4.8%. So it's somewhat of a coincidence, but it also speaks to the much more stability that's in that series than there are in a lot of these non-wage income series.
Thank you.
And then finally, when we have our forecast of tax liability, then we need to project sort of collections, which determines, you know, available resources for the legislature to budget. And this really just gives an idea of how a particular year's, how collections related to a particular year come into the system. You see, this is quarterly, so you see this is during the tax year and this is the year following. There's very little that happens 2 years after the tax year. But you see roughly 20 to 22% a quarter of collections come in the form of withholding. Estimated payments on non-wage income occur. There's two payments due in this quarter, a single payment, and then the final payment really is distributed across December and January as people try to take advantage of the tax implications at the federal level of sending in the payment early. Now, for a normal year, historically, the value of withholding and estimated payments has been roughly equal to the value of collections for all time, and that's because payments and refunds have tended to offset each other. So it's a very nice, it's actually a very nice attribute of collections in normal years that you can really get a good read on how much money was going to be collected on a year shortly after the year has ended. It helps alleviate sort of that data lag issue that we face with tax returns. I've actually mentioned most of these. One other point besides the lag in the information is that our Department of Revenue does not collect every data point that would be available on the detailed submission to the federal government. In particular, Vice Chair Butler, we had this conversation the last time around when we were talking about what could we feasibly get a hold of in terms of Schedule D information.
Right.
And finally, so then we use that collection sort of, we forecast the collections, but we also use the collections to make inferences about liability before we know what it is, before we have the tax returns. So it's sort of a recursive relationship there. And this sort of gives you an idea. This is the progression of 2005 liability forecasts by forecast. So this is the March 2005 forecast. We were forecasting roughly $4.45 billion in tax liability. And you can see as the year wore on and we got those withholding levels and those estimated payment levels, we were revising that up because they were coming in higher than expected. But the primary revision came after April 2006 with an incredible 45% jump in payments and almost flat refunds. And then, and of course, in there as well is, we think, a payment related to a certain stock sale. So all in all, but you can see once you get past that sort of five-quarter point, the revisions to that liability number level out. And in fact, they're slightly below this in the actual data. So some stability there and some saving grace to the problems with actually forecasting what are going on with income out in the economy. Corporate income tax model is based on corporate income tax collections by tax year, so very similar, sort of a liability by tax year basis. We model corporate tax liability as a function of apportioned U.S. corporate profits. That is a variable that's actually in our Global Insights forecast output, so it's readily available. We apportion that to Oregon by our share of personal income, and we use that going forward to project corporate income tax liability. Now, this makes sense because the majority of the liability is associated with multi-state taxpayers. So they will be apportioning their federal tax liability down to Oregon, so it makes sense to base the model on that phenomenon. Did Paul have a question? Oh, you look like that. And then we do...
Representative Gelser.
I have a question. On all of these formulas, F is a multiplier. What does the F stand for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, it's a function. It says that whatever's on the left side is a function of a variety of variables, one or more variables on the right side.
So it's not an algebraic equation where to get to liability you're multiplying that by F.
That's
got it. Thank you.
And then again, we translate that liability forecast back to collections based upon the historical patterns that prevail. Although with corporate income tax collections, when you say the average patterns historically, there really isn't a characteristic year. Based, no one year actually looks the same as the other year. Because it's such the high concentration at the upper level that any one firm making a change to their payment behavior can send the whole system, you know, one way or the other.
This is another example, isn't it, of where very small small numbers don't allow you to make predictions. In effect.
That is correct. And this graph just shows sort of the historical relationship, as it were, between the blue line, which is sort of Oregon corporate tax liability, and that apportioned U.S. profits, or that Oregon profits proxy. The 90s, you can see the growth was actually better, but that's because we, with our high concentration of high-tech firms, benefited disproportionately relative to the U.S. On the other hand, you can see we're not having nearly the rebound relative to the recent spike in corporate profits, and that's due somewhat to the reverse, as well as tax law changes that have been made that lower liability relative to other states. Here is basically the history of close of session forecast errors. The first close of session forecast, in this sense, was released in 1981, and so we have, I think, 12 or 13 observations, fairly small number of observations to make statistical inferences from. But what you can see is, and these are structural comparisons, so we take out any interim actions that might have propped revenues up. We really want to compare the forecast with the actual structural revenues upon which it was based. So you can see only three negatives here, and with an interim number of varying small positives to a couple of very large positives. The 11.1 was the previous high actuals versus close of session. Barring any real change to the forecast on the downward basis this time, we will eclipse that. Mm-hmm. It's currently at 12.1%. So but this gets into, Mr. Chair, what you were talking about, and if you had questions about sort of this notion of bias. I know that's something we've discussed in the past.
It is, and I guess the point I would make is that it appears, both in this area and also in the personal income tax area, that in up years or up biennia, the revenue estimate is always low, and it always has been, as compared with actual receipts. And in down biennia, especially where you weren't able to predict the fact that it was going to switch from up, trending up to trending down, the revenue estimate has always been high as compared to actual receipts. And that's true in whether it's the corporate tax or the personal income tax. I think it's true for both of them in every single case. There are no examples of years where that is not true, or biennia where that's true, as far as I know. Is that right? Am I right so far?
Mr. Chair, I have to defer to some degree to Paul with a longer perspective. But I think this timeline is a short timeline. I think
right.
It needs to be understood that these are some pretty unique circumstances that did prevail. Even high-tech proliferation in the 80s, you could see to some degree. And I don't know that anybody in, say, the 70s was saying Oregon was going to be the hotbed for high-tech. Then the 90s in particular, that boom-bust cycle, pretty unique, at least in that business inventory sense. And then even what we're going through now, which we have yet to fully characterize, I would say these are outliers in terms of growth. And so the question is the degree to which, even if you saw one quarter be extraordinarily strong, you would necessarily buy into that same phenomenon going on for 2-3 years right off the bat. It would seem that if you hedged on the side of long-term trend values, that you would at least make smaller errors than you would if you really tried to buy into the swings in your case.
Well, and that's really the point I think I'm making. It is if you were to take the prediction system you use now, exactly the way you use it now, and take an average of your error rate. I'm just making up a way of doing this, and I recognize that in dealing with these numbers, it's artificial. But if you did that, And you added that average, if it's a positive number, which it is, you'd add it, to the prediction that you make using your system. Overall, most years, your prediction would be more accurate with that fudge factor added in. But you would be off further on the years when you were wrong, on the years when you were too high. Given the way our system works, given the way our system of finance works, that using those numbers that way would probably produce a larger amount of revenue that and in the years when we with the amounts that we can't fully predict because of the nature of the prediction, if you put those numbers in a reserve account when they came in, ignoring them of course when they did not, it would allow you to establish a reserve fund without any significant effect on the actual way we actually budget. And I guess maybe that's the kind of question I'd solicit your comment on.
Well, Mr. Chair, it does transcend sort of the forecasting nature because you bring in then sort of budgeting policy and actions like that. But just speaking in terms of sort of this autoregressive errors that an increase in the forecast last time implies that there will be an increase in the forecast this time. If you were to say, okay, let's just assume, you know, given the way things have gone recently, that we'll just factor in three future forecast revisions now. Yeah, in other words, we'll catch up to the system. Whatever the phenomena is going, causing it to, you know, rise rapidly or decline rapidly, we'll catch up to the real level quickly, but then we'll more than likely overshoot it in the other direction. We'll basically have what is a whipsaw rather than an incrementally changing forecast that tries to get to where it needs to be center line. You'll end up whipsawing the forecast up and down, and I'm not sure which of those two methods, but I suspect that sort of the mean reversion method would end up in lower errors total over time.
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. Okay. A mean reversion method. If you added up all these numbers, you divide them by 11 or 12 or whatever it is, you get the average, in other words. You add that average back to the actual prediction. In most years, your prediction would be closer to what actually happened, I think.
Mr. Chair, for these years, and that's, I think, the problem is if you buy into that now, but then we sort of transition out of this sort of bubble bust and rebubble it, perhaps, cycle it, and enter into more, you know, static long-term growth, then what you would be doing is building a model that does very well to fit sort of the last 15 years and one which may not do any good at being a better predictor for futures. I guess that's the point.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, can I have you go back one slide, please? I think you previously told us that when you look at the 1990 three amount that corporate tax liability was generating right there, it had predicted that it was going to continue to go up like the 96 amount, and then we had the downturn, and then when it continued to show that, and you went out to 1999 and 2000, and it had whereas the first two were spikes, the next few years actually were sustained years of higher. And so then you began to draw the line from back at the first peak towards that third peak. And when you drew that line out, you said, wait a minute, it is sustaining. You got a couple of years of sustained corporate profits. Why don't we just go ahead and anticipate that based upon the fact that we have the projections, we have the predictions, everything appears to be in order. And what I've done in my own crude way, is I've drawn now between the graphs on that you're looking at right now, both on page 14 on your handout, and kind of taken a look at what's happened when you then project that out, and then what happens when you actually then make that final decision that you're going to go ahead with that assumption. That sustained corporate profit is going to go on and continue to be
But then when it drops off, that's when, on the second graph, and that is the close of session forecast error, that we have the 20-plus percent error that says, hey, wait a minute. We have projected that that was going to continue on. It didn't continue on. When it didn't, that's when we have the high percentage rate of error after there have been indications uptick in two different years and then a sustained uptick for a few different or a few more years. Then you just draw that line out and say, okay, fine, we're going to go ahead and predict upon that. In the earlier years, you didn't predict upon it. You said, hey, it's an anomaly. And backed off, and you didn't have the percentages that you were out of whack, it looks like. I think that was an explanation.
Vice Chair Butler, I do need to point out one thing. These downwards are kickers.
Oh.
This is not okay. Gross tax liability. These are net tax liability.
Okay.
So these are just the 95 and 97 kickers.
Okay.
That averaged about $200 million each.
Each.
And so the actual, when you look at this corrected for that, it actually runs up in a nice smooth point to here, and then, of course.
You know, we never really got to the core of the question that I think Representative Butler may be aiming at when we were talking about your new methodology. And let me just put it to you directly. Do you believe that you have a better chance of predicting one out of one recessions in the future rather than either four out of one or zero out of one?
Mr. Chair, if we're referring to the leading index,
I think that's what I'm referring to.
I would definitely say that added information relative to what we had before is valuable. However, there's plenty of economic literature that looks at the disvalue of additional information. But from a methodological and from an analytical standpoint, it would seem that having that, and remember, and one of the things about that is it doesn't change the fact of economic ups and downs. All it does is give you an advanced lead time. Ask yourself if we had actually thought, okay, there was going to be a recession, say, fourth quarter of 2000, and built that into the March and May 2001 forecasts. All it means is that the pain of the budget reconciliation would have occurred earlier, and so that the effect of any sort of, say, administrative changes or whatever would have had longer to take effect. You know, so it doesn't change the fact of, you know, what we deal with here in terms of volatile revenue streams and fiscal is only to really try to get a lead, you know, and to minimize the pain, basically, of dealing with those ups and downs.
Well, for those of us who are actually here in 2002 and 2003, when we were trying to adjust the budget, I would say that having a few months lead time would have made a huge, additional lead time would have made a huge difference to us as we were struggling to catch up, recognizing that at the end of a biennium, the chances of making up losses are nil. And at that point, we borrowed a very large sum of money because we had absolutely no other choice. If we had known a year earlier than we did know that we were going to be in that boat, we would have budgeted very differently. And I wouldn't say that we'd get to a soft landing because the kind of budget cuts we made were gruesome. But it would have been slightly less gruesome, perhaps, in the outcome. It's not a matter of blaming anybody. It's simply an acknowledgement of the fact that if your predictions improve around turns in the economy, that will have a huge impact on our planning and on the outcome for state and local programs. Thank you. We're really past our time for today. I would appreciate it if you could do the next two slides very quickly. We'll adjourn about 5 minutes later than we normally do so people can get on to their next committees. And then we'll have to put off a review of the lottery until another time.
Sure. And in fact, this is just the 07-09 forecast that has been public now, and the bottom line being about $14 billion in revenues. Really, the risks are relate to two assumptions that have been made, or assumption changes that have been made, and those relate to capital gains and corporate profits, both of which, as I've just explained, have seen incredible growth in the last few years, and it still remains to be seen exactly what degree of that was a permanent correction, a correction of the correction versus some other type of bubble or temporary one-time aspect. And so those are your downside risks. And as
some of you have heard from our prior presentation, when we run a worst-case scenario, major correction in capital gains, major correction in corporate profits, plus just an overall economic scenario, we get to up to $1.5 billion loss of revenue next biennium, so down from $14 billion available resources to $12.5 billion.
And did you give us an upside?
Mr. Chair, it's interesting because our view is that the risk around this forecast is asymmetric, that it's much more compressed on the upside because basically we are living the best-case scenario. We've just been through 3 years of a better-case scenario than would have ever been painted 3 years ago. So the odds of that continuing to that degree for two more years is far less than these reversal scenarios. Now, the center point is still the most likely, we feel, but it's just that the odds of us being 10% above on those revenues is much smaller than the odds of us potentially being 10% below.
Well, Mr. Chair, may I make an observation? I think that the basic tenet of Vice Chair Butler's comments holds true, because if we make a forecast just by looking back, we would make a very gross mistake. So our forecast is forward-looking. We consider almost everything under the sun, including the past and our view about the future too. So, auto-regressive forecast would be very dangerous.
Yes, and I agree. And it's apparent that I did not explain my view very well, because I certainly do not suggest any such thing. Because of course it has to be forward-looking in order for it to be useful to us. We appreciate very much your presentation. I think we all have other committees to get to. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.